Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce our first plenary speaker today. It's Dr. Mario Beauregard. He has a PhD in neuroscience from the University of Montreal. After graduating from the University of Montreal, he did two postdoctoral fellowships in experimental neuropsychology, the first at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston, and the second at the Montreal Neurological Institute, which is at McGill University. He is presently associate research professor at the University of Montreal in the departments of radiology and psychology, as well as a member of the Neuroscience Research Center. He is the author of over 100 peer-reviewed publications in psychiatry, neuroscience, and psychology. He was the recipient of the 2006 Joel Luber Award for his contributions to the field of neurotherapy, and he is also the author of the best-selling book, The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist's Case for the Existence of the Soul. And this morning he's going to talk to us about the neuroscience of spirituality. Please help me welcome Mario Beauregard.
Thank you, Matt, for this nice presentation and also for the invitation to participate in this meeting. Today, in my lecture, what I'm going to present is mostly based on the book Matt was talking about, The Spiritual Brain. Okay, so in terms of the outline of my lecture today, I'll start with a definition of what is the emerging field of neuroscience of spirituality. And then I'll switch to the metaphysical assumptions of mainstream neuroscience, because there's a very important link between how neuroscientists see the studies about spirituality and religion and these metaphysical assumptions. Then I'll present a few studies done about this concept of a God spot or gram module in the temporal lobe, a region of the brain. I'll also focus a bit on the research project that we carried in Carmelite nuns during a mystical state. After that, I'll speak briefly about the notion of non-local or extended mind, and I will end up with a few conclusions. Okay. Okay. So let's start with the neuroscience of spirituality, the construct. So what it is exactly. So it's a new field of research, which is at the junction of neuroscience, psychology, and religion also. And the goal of this new field of research is to explore the neural correlates of religious, spiritual, and mystical experiences. And I'm using here the acronym RSMEs to refer to these experiences. And we know that these experiences relate to a very basic dimension of human experience across history, and they are reported also across all cultures. And we know also that these experiences very often will lead to marked psycho-spiritual transformation. So one of the basic assumptions of this new field of research is that these experiences are mediated by the brain, and it is the case of all other human experiences, for instance, emotion, perception, memories. But it's important here to distinguish to be mediated by versus to be produced by. So there's a big distinction, because we're speaking here in terms of what we call neural correlates. So another thing to note when we speak about this new field is that trying to identify the neural correlates of these experiences does not diminish at all the meaning or the value of these experiences. And of course, reality of God, the external reality of God, cannot be proved or disproved simply with the identification of the neural correlates of these experiences using novel brain imaging techniques. So this is a very important point, obviously. So it's a growing field. I would say that it has started really about 10 years ago. And now there's a lot of work that is done with Buddhist contemplatives. So you find very different universities and different researchers involved in this field, like Alan Wallace, for instance, and Cliff Saron at UC Davis. You have Richard Davidson, who is working with Tibetan monks, he's in very good terms with the Dalai Lama. So they're doing a sort of research collaboration that has been ongoing for a few years now. And you have other researchers like Paul Ekman, who is a famous researcher in the field of emotion and the brain, and he's now more and more interested in this field. And you have other researchers at Princeton like Jonathan Cohen and Brent Field. And so it's really growing. But at this point, there's much more research done with Buddhist meditators than with Christian contemplatives. You also have at University of Pennsylvania, Andrew Newberg. And so he's one of the main leaders in this field. And he's working mostly with Buddhist meditators, but he's done a pilot study a few years ago with Franciscan nuns at prayer. So there's a very interesting study that has been published at the end of the 70s in Great Britain, and it's been called The Spiritual Nature of Man. It has produced a book, and this book was written by a famous zoologist called Alistair Hardy. And Alistair Hardy was very much interested in various types of spiritual experiences across UK. He has created a unit in the 60s called the Religious Experience Research Unit at the Manchester College in Oxford. And he collected for a few decades several thousand letters, over 4,000 letters. And these letters were reports of various types of spiritual religious experiences. And these letters were received from people from all sorts of socioeconomic levels across UK. And analyzing all these letters, RD and his colleagues have been able to identify the most common triggers for genuine religious spiritual experiences. And the first, statistically, the first trigger was depression or despair. Then it was prayer or meditation or contemplation, and then natural beauty. Hardy and also other scholars have demonstrated also that these experiences have several consequences, usually very positive consequences. So one of the consequences is a sense of transcendence of the personal identity. And there's also very often an enhanced sense of connection to an unity with others and the world, and a new sense also of purpose and meaning to life. And interestingly, the people reporting these experiences score lower on psychopathology scales, and they will score higher on psychological well-being scales than people who are not reporting these experiences. And they're less likely also to engage in antisocial behaviors. And they have lower rates of crime or excessive alcohol consumptions and also drug addiction. So now I'll speak briefly about some of the metaphysical assumptions of mainstream neuroscience. So one of these assumptions is what we call determinism. And determinism is the idea that the future states of isolated systems can be predicted precisely from current states. So translated to the mind-brain question, it means that you can predict human behavior simply by studying electrical and chemical processes in the brain. A related assumption is reductionism. Reductionism means that complex systems, like the brain, for instance, can be explained as the sum of their part, their component. And a related concept is the notion of upward causation. It means that causation will flow only upward from the simpler to the more complex. So applied to the brain, for instance, it means that what we call mind and consciousness emerge from brain, which is a very sophisticated system, and they are controlled by neuroelectrical and neurochemical processes. Another assumption is materialism. So it means that everything in the universe can be explained ultimately in terms of basic particles and the elementary forces of physics. It's an assumption that comes directly from classical physics. And according to this assumption, the brain is made up entirely of material elements, fields and particles. And so what we call mind, higher mental functions, consciousness, self, or free will, are simply byproducts of electrical and chemical processes in the brain. And this is why very famous neuroscientists, materialist neuroscientists, use expressions such as neuronal man or the synaptic self to refer to human beings. Another interesting assumption is naturalism. So this means that all phenomena can be explained strictly in terms of natural causes and laws, and then religious, spiritual experiences are simply then byproducts of brain activity. They cannot refer to a transcendental reality, if you will. A good illustration of this kind of view is the one that Francis Crick championed during his life. Crick was the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, as you know, and in one of his books, The Astonishing Hypothesis, he wrote that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associate molecules. And he also proposed that the belief in the existence of God might be due to mutant molecules in the brain that he called teotoxins, a poison in the brain. And he was very serious when he wrote that. He was very convinced of that. I'll speak now about this notion of a God spot or God module in the temporal lobe. So this is the portion of the brain that we call the temporal lobe. And so this is the external view. And you have also structures internally, structures like the amygdala, for instance, the hippocampus, who would be involved in this so-called God spot. So the hypothesis that there's a God spot or God module in the temporal lobe comes from neurological studies of epileptic patients. And about 30 years ago, but it started even before, some neurologists noticed that when patients, epileptic patients, have seizures in the temporal lobe region, sometimes they will report religious or spiritual experiences. Only about 2 to 3% of patients do that. And based on this, well, the neurologists concluded that the temporal lobe was the seat of religion, and that the belief in God and the experiences of God must be located or must be due to misfiring of neurons in the temporal lobe region. And so they proposed that the great religious figures of the past, like Teresa of Avila, for instance, St. Paul, Joan of Arc, all these famous figures were suffering from temporal lobe epilepsy. Not too long ago, a neurologist, John Hughes, from the University of Chicago, conducted very thorough studies about these figures, their writings, and all the available evidence, and he concluded that there was no real evidence indicating that these religious figures were indeed suffering from temporal lobe epilepsy. And one thing to note, which is very important, is that most people who have these experiences are not epileptics. And very few, like I said, very few epileptics will report religious or spiritual experiences during the seizures. But still, based on this notion, there's a famous neuroscientist, Ramachandran at UCSD. We did a study over 10 years ago, and he investigated two patients with temporal lobe epilepsy, and he compared these patients with a group of highly religious people, and he presented to the subjects various list of words, sexual words, violent words, religious words, and even neutral words, words with no emotional charge. And he was measuring what we call the electrodermal response, which is related to the sweat gland activity. It's considered to be an index of emotional reactivity. And so he found greater arousal, greater response in patients, in his two patients suffering from temporal lobe epilepsy, in response specifically to the religious words. And strictly based on this, he concluded that there was a God spot in the temporal lobe, which underlies the evolutionary instinct to believe in religion. But there are many problems with this pilot study, because there was no measure of brain activity while the two groups of subjects were exposed to the diverse categories of words. So we don't know really if the temporal lobe was activated. And another thing important to note is that just viewing the words did not induce very deep religious or spiritual experiences in the subjects with temporal lobe epilepsy. And also, a major problem is the sample size. He was only investigating two patients. There's another scientist, Michael Persinger from Laurentian University in Ontario, Canada. He's American, but he's been in Canada for over 30 years now. And Persinger believes that religion is a cognitive virus, and that religious belief and also religious experiences are simply artifacts of brain disorders. So he believes that these experiences and belief and experiences are the product of what he called micro-seizures in the temporal lobe. So in other words, these experiences and these beliefs are simply delusions created by a dysfunctional brain. And he theorized about 30 years ago that if this is true, then it should be possible in principle to induce these experiences simply by stimulating electromagnetically the temporal lobes of the brain. And so he devised an helmet that has been called by the journalist the God helmet. It's a football helmet. And so you have elements in this helmet that allows you to stimulate, you know, both sides of the brains with weak electromagnetic currents. There are a lot of problems with his work. It's not really good science, because in his recruitment of subjects, he will recruit only students who are most suggestible. And also, the students are members of the Department of Psychology, where he's a professor. And he gives better grades to the students who participate in his experiments. And he's never done any brain imaging study to confirm that his stimulation was effectively activating the temporal lobe. And also, on a phenomenological viewpoint, very few genuine religious or spiritual experiences have been reported over a period of 30 years. And so, a few years ago, a group of Swedish researchers, led by Granvist, a psychologist, well, these researchers had their doubts about his work, and they decided to try to replicate his findings. And they use exactly the same equipment. Persinger shipped them an helmet. He gave them all the information regarding his protocols, the intensity of the current applicated, and so on and so forth. And these researchers were very clever, so they decided to use a double-blind protocol approach. In this kind of approach, neither the experimenters nor the subjects know to which group they belong, because they were administrating also sham currents. So when all these factors were controlled for, there was no effect of stimulation of the temporal lobe. And so this question of whether the temporal lobes are involved in RSMEs is still open. Because like I said before, of course, all human experiences are mediated through the nervous system. So the temporal lobe may well be one key region involved in these experiences, but that does not mean that the temporal lobe generates these experiences. Now I'll speak briefly about the study we did with the Carmelite nuns. We were interested to see what was going on in the brain during a so-called mystical state, mystical experience. And when we speak about mysticism, according to Stace, this mystical experience will include a sense of certainty of contact with a higher truth or a higher power underlying the universe. This is one key characteristic. Of course, these experiences are always interpreted in a certain framework. So in the Christian tradition, the absolute is experienced as a transcendent personality, which is full of unconditional love and compassion, and with whom one's personality becomes transiently merged with. Whereas in the Buddhist tradition, the absolute is considered totally impersonal. So it's a major difference. According to the scholars interested in perennial philosophy, these scholars believe that mystics of all the great religious traditions perceive the divine ground of the universe that underlies mind and consciousness, but that it is the interpretation that is different. So in terms of the main characteristics of the mystical state or experience, Stace proposed at the beginning of the 60s that first there's a sense of union with God. There's also a sense of having touched the ultimate ground of reality. And this experience is very hard to communicate also. And sometimes there will be also a sense of union with humankind in the universe at large. And this experience is usually beyond space and time. And there is also a very positive emotional component associated with this experience. Usually, the people will experience joy, unconditional love, and peace, serenity. So we, in our research project, we decided to use brain imaging techniques to identify what we call neural correlates of this mystical experience. And in order to do that, we use two different brain imaging techniques. One is functional magnetic resonance imaging. And so this is a scanner that allows you to identify in 3D in the brain the structures and the networks that are involved in various types of cognitive or emotional functions. And we also use quantitative EEG, and EEG measures electrical activity in the brain. And this brain activity was measured in a group of Carmelite nuns. They were cloistered nuns during such a state. And in order to evaluate the phenomenological aspect of this experience, we used the mysticism scale that was developed by Ralph Hood in the 70s. So in the Carmelite order is a Roman Catholic order, which has been oriented toward mysticism mainly by two famous religious figures, St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross during the 16th century. And these cloistered nuns live a life of silent prayer. So they are allowed to talk for only 2 20-minute periods after lunch and also after dinner every day. So we managed to recruit 15 of them during a period of 2 years. It was extremely difficult to do that at first because the nuns did not understand what we were trying to achieve. And they told us that we were very naive if we believed that we were going to find God in the brain, because God created the brain and the universe. And so we told them, no, that's not the goal. We want simply to see what's going on in the brain during a mystical state. Also, they were afraid that we were going to use the findings to say, like many other materialist neuroscientists, that, you see, since there are neurocorrelates in the brain, this means that these experiences are simply delusions. And so it's been very difficult to convince them that this was not the case also. And so these nuns, the mean age was 50, and the range was 23 to 64. And these nuns did not have any history of psychiatric or neurological disorder. And overall, they had been associated with the Carmelite Order for 19 years. And we estimated that altogether, they had spent about 210,000 hours in prayer and contemplation. So they are really like Olympic athletes of prayer and contemplation. So one of the techniques, like I was saying, was fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging, and the goal was to identify the brain regions and the circuit involved in the mystical state. And in terms of the results, using the mysticism scale, we found that three items were most significant. The first one is the item saying that I've had an experience in which something greater than myself seemed to absorb me. I've experienced profound joy also, and I've had an experience which I knew to be sacred. We also interviewed them at the end of the experiment, and many of them, most of them actually, told us that during the mystical state, they experienced the presence of God and also his unconditional and infinite love. And they reported also feelings of plenitude and peace. Now, in terms of brain activation maps, we found activation in the famous Adenian under right GTM. This represents the right temporal lobe section. But we found activation also in various other regions that are normally associated with self-awareness, positive emotions, and also body representation, a body representation within space. Because all these elements, of course, were altered during the mystical state. This is Sister Diane. She's the superior of the Carmelite convent in Montreal. And this was the EEG experiment. So you see her wearing a cap containing a number of electrodes, allowing us to record electrical activity in the brain. And in terms of the results on the mysticism scale, there were even more elements, because the fMRI scanner is a very noisy environment. We use reduction noise techniques, but still, in the EEG experiment, they were totally isolated in a room, shielded completely, and in this room, you cannot hear anything. So this room reminded them a lot of their own cells at the convent. So it was easier for them to achieve a deeper experience in this sort of room. And so they reported pretty much the same elements, but other elements also, like I've had an experience in which I felt that everything in this world is part of the same old, and also I've had an experience which is impossible to communicate. And at the end, when we interviewed them, they also reported the feeling of presence of God, and also feeling of unconditional love, plenitude and peace, and also a sense of surrendering to God. In terms of the results, We saw a lot of theta wave all over the brain in various regions, and also a bit of high beta activity. Theta waves are slow waves that are seen just before you fall asleep. It is also associated with deep meditative states and also with the retrieval of material from the unconscious. We also analyzed the coherence between various regions, various electrodes, and this coherence variable tells you something about the functional connectivity between various regions of the brain. And in the mystical condition or state, there was an increase in terms of coherence in the for theta waves and also for alpha waves. Alpha waves are associated with deep relaxation. So the overall, these results indicate that there's no single God spot in the brain. These experiences are complex. They are multidimensional. They involve changes in self-awareness, in cognition, and perception, and emotion also. And so it's logical that several brain regions and networks will be associated with these experiences, at least in a Christian perspective, because I have not investigated this question in other traditions. For the EEG experiment, like I was saying before, it's interesting to note that prominent theta waves in the frontal portion of the brain have been seen during Zen meditation, a form of Buddhist meditation. And also it's been seen during a blissful state in meditation, in Buddhist meditation also. I will now speak a bit about the notion of non-local or extended mind. And I'll start with a case of Pam Reynolds, a musician from Atlanta, who was suffering in 1991 from a big aneurysm at the base of her brain, in the brainstem. And the brainstem controls all the vital functions, like heart rate and respiration. And so her life was threatened. And she heard of neurosurgeon Dr. Robert Spitzler at the Barrow Institute in Phoenix, who devised about 30 years ago a surgical procedure that is called standstill. And in the standstill procedure, the body temperature is lowered to about 58 degrees Fahrenheit, and the heartbeat and breathing are stopped, and the blood circulation is stopped as well. So the blood is drained from the head. And when the heart is stopped, usually after 10 to 15 seconds, the brain will shut down. So you don't record any EEG activity. It becomes flat. And what's fascinating is that during this period of 1 hour, while she was clinically dead, she's had what we call an out-of-body experience. So she's had the impression of leaving her physical body, and she's been able to describe very accurately the surgical tools and the procedure that were associated with her surgery. She reported also very accurately dialogues between the surgeons and the nurses. And how do we know that? Well, the surgical team, they were keeping a logbook of everything that they were doing, for instance, at the 10th minute of the intervention, at the 20th minute. So that's how they've been able to compare the information. And in a later stage of this experience, she's had the impression of leaving the surgical room and traveling along a tunnel at a very high speed. And at the end of the tunnel, she said that she met with deceased relatives and friends. And in the later stage of her experience, she met with a beautiful being of light, a light that was loving, warm, intelligent. And during that, at that time, she realized that her own soul was part of God, and that everything in existence was created by or from this light, which was the essence of God. And of course, her life was totally transformed after that. Before that, she was agnostic. She didn't have any religious or spiritual beliefs. And it's a very interesting case. It's not the only case that we have like that. There are other cases. Another interesting case of a man in France named Jean Marzel, who was clinically dead, and during this state of clinical death, he was able to perceive in an out-of-body experience the serial number of the surgical table on which he was lying, on which the physical body was lying. And he told this serial number to his surgeon. And at first, the surgeon was very skeptical, but he was bothered by this information, and he decided to go check the information. And the serial number was very accurate. And so it seems that when the brain does not function seemingly, because in this case, EEG was used, and it's possible that EEG cannot detect everything in terms of brain activity, very subtle forms of activity, but still, this case and the other cases strongly suggest that what we call mind and consciousness can continue when the brain does not function anymore. And also, religious and spiritual mystical experiences can happen when the brain apparently does not function. And so to test this possibility of a veridical perception during an out-of-body experience, we will begin in a few weeks from now in the Montreal Hospital a research project during hypothermic cardiac standstill. So the patients will be clinically dead for a period of time of about 20 minutes on average. And we will present on a computer monitor located at about 7 feet above the ground a series of emotionally laden pictures, beautiful pictures. And nobody in the surgical team will be able to see these pictures because the screen will be oriented towards the ceiling. And the patients will not know in advance that they were going to participate in something like this. We will interview the patients afterwards, a few days after the surgery. And so we want to verify this possibility of veridical perception when the brain does not apparently function. Because so far, the cases that have been reported are considered by mainstream scientists as anecdotal, you know, and so they want a very strict scientific protocol, a rigorous protocol. And so that's why we have decided to do this. We will start in Montreal, but eventually there will be other research, hospital research centers around the world. We will conduct the same kind of experiment. I also want to touch a bit about the notion of entangled minds or extended mind. And I'm referring here to so-called psi phenomena. These phenomena statistically are low-level effect, but they are typically too high to be pure chance. So, for instance, the researcher that you see there, Dean Radin, who has written Entangled Minds and also The Conscious Universe, he has reviewed thousands of experiences that have been done during the 20th century and 21st century. And, for instance, he reviewed in what we call a meta-analysis of about over 2,000 studies, Ganzfeld studies. Ganzfeld is a German term meaning sensory deprivation. Well, he found that in these studies, the odds against chance of were a million billion to one. So this phenomena really exists statistically. However, we don't have yet good explanation for it. He also examined the studies suggesting that it's possible for the human mind to affect physical systems located away from the body, systems like what we call a random number generator. It's like an electronic flipper, if you will, which is based on quantum processes. And usually this machine will produce series of either zeros or ones in a random fashion. However, when you ask subjects to influence volitionally these machines. Sometimes people are able to do this. And so he reviewed in his meta-analysis over 800 studies, and the odds against chance were beyond a trillion to one. So again, it seems that the human mind is also able to exert an influence on physical systems outside of their own body. Another series of experiments, interesting, were done by Grinberg-Zilberbaum, a neurophysiologist in Mexico City. And he did studies in which pairs of subjects in the same room were meditating together for a period of about 20 minutes. And both of these subjects were wearing EEG caps. And after 20 minutes, one of the subjects was sent to another room, and the other subject was exposed to visual flashes, photic stimuli. And the EEG activity was measured in the two subjects at the same time. And what's fascinating is that, the subject who was exposed to the visual stimuli was responding in a normal fashion. So we were measuring what we call visual evoked potentials, as expected. But the other member of the pair, connected to this other subject, was during 20%, 25% of the time presenting the same kind of pattern. So there was a sort of link of connection between the two members of the pair. And when the emotional bonding, the emotional connection was greater, the effect was more robust. So this is very interesting. Mental influence is also possible on living system. It's called biopsychokinesis, and it's been studied at the Mind Science Foundation. And so it's possible for humans to influence other humans with specific intention. So electrodermal response have been measured in vivo, for instance. But it's also possible to influence other types of biological organism, like enzymes, for instance, or bacteria, or even hemolysis in the blood, so which is the breakage of the red blood cells membrane in vitro. And it's also it's been shown also that it's possible to influence the growth rate of plants. So all these so-called psi phenomena suggest that mind and consciousness are less tightly bound in space than it's been previously supposed, and that so the effect of mind and consciousness are not limited simply within the brain and the body. And this means also that mind and matter are not radically separated, contrary to what René Descartes was claiming during the 17th century. So now I will end up with a few conclusions. First, I argue that the brain mediates but does not produce mind and consciousness and religious, spiritual, and mystical experiences. And for me, what I call the psychological world or psyche cannot be reduced to the physical realm, to physis. So it means that for me, both psyche and physis are two manifestations of the same underlying principle. They have the same origin, yet they are distinct in their manifestations. Also, it seems more and more evident that our brains do not produce mind and consciousness, but they act more like a reducing valve. And so the brain would allow us only to experience a narrow portion of reality most of the time. However, there are under certain circumstances, it's possible to alter this mind-brain coupling, for instance, during prayer and contemplation, also during, of course, clinical death. And so normally our brain limits our experience of the spiritual world, and so you have to alter this reducing valve in order to access to another realm. And this is not a new concept. It's been proposed by the French philosopher Henri Bergson, beginning of the 19th century, and also by William James and the writer Aldous Huxley. Also, some of the studies I've shown you and other studies indicate that several of the metaphysical assumptions of classical science are not valid with respect to the mind-brain questions. And I have had the time to present a series of brain imaging studies, very interesting studies showing that we can exert a very important influence over electrical and chemical processes in our brain. And this means that humans are not biological robots totally controlled by their brains. And like I said before, mind and consciousness, to me, are fundamental and irreducible. And they seem to be able to operate also exosomatically, that is, outside the body. And finally, I believe that there's basic unity and interconnectedness between everything in the universe, which includes both the physical world and the mental world. I thank you for your attention. Yeah, most of the material is, you can find it in the Spiritual Brain. It's HarperCollins is the publisher.
And there are copies on the book table out here if you're interested in the Spiritual Brain.
How about the reverse experience of the terror, fear, destruction as you go through the mental state, consciousness, the way you're on the brain? Any records of that?
Well, of terror, there's not much literature about these states in brain imaging studies so far, no. The study seems to indicate that the more quiet you are and the most likely you'll be able to experience religious or spiritual experience. So this is why these experiences are very often associated with prayer and contemplation. And also contemplation also of natural beauties. And based on what we measured, we were observing mostly a slowing of brain activity in terms of brain waves. So I would think that if you have sensory deprivation, then the probability to experience something transcendent must be greater. About the other questions, I'm not sure I understood the meaning regarding neuroscience. Could you rephrase it? Yes, but like you said in the presentation, at this point, we are not able to manipulate the brain in order to generate systematically these genuine religious spiritual experiences. So Persinger is claiming that that's what he's doing, but in reality, when you look at his work, he does not succeed. So at this point, we don't see how it would be possible to do this. Because in my view, you can alter the functioning of the brain. That humans are able to do this using various means, for instance, even psychotropic drugs. But I believe that in order to have a very intense spiritual experience, there's an involvement also of the spiritual dimension. It's a two-way process. So you do not decide as a human to have, you cannot control everything. You can be more receptive, for instance, during a state of prayer, contemplation, but that does not mean that you will have such an experience. That's what the Carmelite nuns told us. So you can pray, contemplate for 10, 20 years, but you're not going to have a very deep mystical experience. You never know. So it's not controlled only by humans. The spiritual world has a great, is greatly important, in the occurrence of these experiences. That I'm convinced of that. Yeah.
Can you repeat the question so we can get it on the tape?
Okay. Could you reframe the first question? Because okay, so the question is consciousness controlled by spiritual entities versus brain processes?
Mental processes are varied, and consciousness or conscious states also. So you have all sorts. There's a wide spectrum of mental states and conscious states, and I would say that some conscious states and mental processes are clearly more related to activity of the brain and the body. But other forms of conscious states and mental processes are more oriented toward transcendence. And in those cases, I believe there's an intervention of spiritual dimension. So that would be my my view about this. Yeah.
Scripture says that we are a tent for our true persons, that the physical body is a tent. Has anybody tried to study it backwards, that we are actually a spiritual being, and then when we see something with our eyes, that's actually instantiating the physical into our, what we see spiritually, into our physical bodies. We see with spiritual eyes, but then our physical eyes turn into chemical pieces, including our physical bodies.
Yeah. Well, that's what I believe, but with the tools, with the actual technology in neuroscience, it's not possible to directly measure, directly go up the spirit or the soul level. We can only do this indirectly. For instance, in studying near-death experiences during cardiac arrest, for instance, but it's only indirect. So we don't have the technology to directly tap, to the spiritual world or the, unfortunately. I agree.
Have you come up against a lot of challenge with the work that you have done?
Oh, well, it depends. I would say that, it's only a very narrow portion of neuroscientists who are
absolutely convinced of materialism and atheism, and openly they won't pronounce themselves, but they don't go out publicly saying that. But in private, I've noticed that a lot of neuroscientists are, in reality, are quite uncertain about the absolute character of materialism and all these things. They know that there are several lines of evidence challenging their views, but since they function in a materialist system, they don't want to go out publicly and say it because they are afraid for their own career. It's a very practical question, but at the same time, sometimes they will tell me privately, "Keep going. We have to, arrive eventually to a new scientific worldview, and we're sick and tired of, materialism, and it has lasted for 300 years now, but we know that we're not going anywhere with this, but however, they don't want to go publicly with it."
The Ramachandran work, of course, in 1997 was presented at the Society of Neuroscience.
Oh, yeah.
And never published.
No.
And I'm wondering how much of the Pam Reynolds work, Cy work, and others published in the journal.
The work about Pam Reynolds has been published in a book written by her cardiologist, Michael Sabam, in Atlanta. It's not been published yet in a peer review journal.
Okay. No. So that's one aspect of it. But of course, the other aspect is, as you get to theta waves, you get close to delta waves associated with especially REM states and three states. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about, and of course, not all three states are associated with REM. Mm-hmm. But it seems like we're getting really close to the dream state. And so we don't understand the dream state either. And yet it appears to be a physical aspect of our being able to really only to think of contacting. For most of us, except Jacob and others, maybe had dreams, that maybe they contact another reality.
Yeah.
So the question is, might we really still dealing with the physical state here? You mentioned EEGs. You look in the gamma range. If there's some thought that if you get above 30, 40 hertz, higher, very complex activity can occur, and especially in these cardiac standpoint situations, super late form, if you have that issue.
Yes.
So, but maybe address some of those things.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's possible that, these, of course, it's very hard to disentangle what is spiritual or mental versus what is purely physical when you use tools like EEG, for instance. And however, we know that in a case such as Pam Reynolds, when there is no detectable EEG activity, and when it's seen in other patients neurologically, we know that these patients are not supposed to be able to perceive, to have feelings or self-awareness, or so it tells us, it gives us hints that there may be something else, something different. But like I said, it's not because you don't record any EEG activity that there's no residual activity in the brain in subcortical structures, for instance, because the people are not really dead on a permanent basis; they come back. Yes. Yeah. Although in her case, the tested brainstem reactivity, and there was no reactivity using clicks, auditory clicks. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yes. Of course. Yeah. 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 I agree. Mm-hmm.
Question about your upcoming standstill experience.
Mm-hmm. It's quite possible that, of course, because this stencil surgery now is done routinely in various hospital centers around the world, and
very rarely will the patients report an out-of-body experience. So it's clear that the induction of such an experience is not controlled at all by the surgical teams or the experimenters. And we don't know why, for instance, it will happen in one case out of thousands of patients. And I agree that it's possibility that it's not decided